It doesn't mean that next time, you know, some other teacher comes, now you are done with tenet. Don't think that way, right? Don't think that way. You can again ask, you know, the next teacher, whosoever it might be, to teach the same tenet. And then you, to your amazement, first of all, you know, we see that just from the beginning, you will see a flavor in it. You know, your involvement in it. And on top of that, you can see the, you know, there is the increase in the pace. Because now you don't get lost in the small, small things. The small things are already there with you. You know, so you can go in much greater pace. You know, so there's a deep sense of joy. And then you will come to realize that, oh, indeed, so this is what I need to have for my meditation. You know, so this will really make your meditation so clear. Just imagine, you know, you're about to sleep, right? And just think about the state of your mind. Dull, foggy, you know, like that. Imagine, you take a half an hour's nap or 1 hour nap, you wake up, you're so fresh. And imagine how things are appearing to you. So, with these, you know, analysis on tenet systems will make your mind so fresh, you know. It's so like, it's just, you're awake from, say, 7-8 hours of sleep. And you're so fresh, right? So with that freshness, imagine if your mind is that fresh during your whole meditation period, how joyful that would be for you. So very slow, you are in the same position, you know, and then physically, you know, it might appear interesting, or, you know, oh, something so pious, meditate for such a long time. But in true sense, the meditation, you know, going in a very low pace, very slow pace. So sometimes even degenerating the quality, because the mind is so, so sluggish, foggy, you know. This is all my experience. So whereas with these things, then, so what are you meditating upon? As I said earlier, on the four seals of the Buddha's teaching. What are they? Right from the beginning, it already speaks about the analytical meditation. All composite things are impermanent. You know, so there you have to really work out with your thought. It's not just single-pointedly, you know, so comfortably sitting on, you know, and then meditating on just single object. It's not like that. So what? The first teaching of the Buddha is on impermanence, which involves lots of rigorous thought. It's not the gross impermanence, gross plus subtle impermanence, which we already discussed in tenet. You know, it's not something that our eye perceptions can see it. It's not something that somebody tells you and you understand it. You know, somebody tells you, then you reflect on it, then gradually it will take root in your understanding. Right? So it needs a lot of rigorous thinking. So for which there should be sharpness, freshness, alertness of your mind. So for which tenet system is just the right thing. If you are someone like Jiza Milarepa, you must have heard about Jiza Milarepa, the great, great saint, you know, the most popular example of someone who has achieved enlightenment within a single lifetime. If you're like him, who can dedicate everything for the Dharma, you know, and the mere first moment of your hearing about simply the name of your teacher makes you, you know, the body with goosebumps, you know, goose pimples, then it's great. But if this is not the case, better to be on the safe side from tenet and these things. Don't expect like Jiza Milarepa happening to you, you know. So this is how we should be so realistic and practical in a pursuit. Okay, so I'll try to go as much as possible. Tenet, and of course this one, the teaching on emptiness part, which I'm going to correlate with the topic single and what different, you know. The one, the sameness or distinctness, whatever you might call it. So that, in that relation, teaching on emptiness is what I'm going to do on auspicious day. In fact, I've already translated that bit from Lama Tsongkhapa's text into English on emptiness, you know. Very comprehensive and concise, short, you know. So that I've already translated this morning, and then I'm going to put up that on computer, you know. I'm going to enter into computer. So this time, even if, you know, things don't really become clear to you, don't expect yourself to have a very clear understanding. And when it doesn't happen, don't feel sad. So this is what you should be expecting. And if at least if there's a feeling that, oh look, this is so complicated, you know, I'm yet to really understand anything, and yet we are covering so much. If this kind of feeling is happening, this is a good sign that you are learning something, you know. So this means you are preparing yourself. Whatever you learned so much, so far, which of course because of your inability to correlate one another, you know, you get an impression as though like you haven't learned anything. But the next time, you know, as you go on, you know, Chittamatra, Madhyamika, then you try to go back to read what you have learned, then you see that, oh, they're quite easy. You've quite learned a lot, right? Number one. And number two, when in future, if somebody else comes and then teach you the same tenet, then you'll see the difference. That's really amazing. You don't, so this is what is known as, you know, implanting imprints within one's mind. Implanting imprints, you know. So during the first teaching, you get the impression as though like you haven't learned anything. But then during the teaching on the same text, you see that you understand everything. It's not because that you have, you know, your intelligence has all of a sudden, Manjushri has given you the power. It's not that. It's because of the, you know, because of the imprint laid during the first teaching, you know, whose the understanding of which seemed to be just zero. But actually in true sense, because that you are unable to correlate everything, you get impression as though like you have learned nothing. But in true sense, there's a deep, you know, the plantation of imprints within your mind stream. The indication of that is that during the second teaching, the same text, you see that, what? Am I a different person? Mm-hmm. You know, from the first teaching. So this is kind of impression that you are surely going to get, which in fact I got when I was studying the, Abhidhamma Kosha, which is the Treasury of Knowledge by Vasubandhu. At the first teaching, I attended, you know, one teacher, teacher teaching that text. And then my colleagues, actually they already received the teachings earlier. So I thought, you know, I'm not inferior in terms of intelligence as compared to, you know, those of my colleagues. But then, to my surprise, my teacher, when he was asking questions, he taught little bit and then started asking questions. And then I didn't have anything to answer. And whereas my colleagues, you know, they were answering and they were really enjoying the discussion. So I was really shocked. Is it that, you know, this is not my cup of tea? Or, you know, what's something wrong happening to me? I felt a little bit sad. And then later on, again, another teacher teaching the same text, the same topic, on the basis of the same commentary. And however, of the two teachers, the second one is less, you know, emphatic on the details. The second teacher was going on faster pace. However, when the second teacher was teaching it, then I could almost understand everything. And then I realized that, you know, when I try to compare the two teachers in terms of the text, it's just the same text. In terms of the commentary, it's the same commentary. the rebase. And then in terms of the actual explanation, the first one was explaining more. The second one, you know, just briefly and then going so at a great pace. However, during the second, I can understand a lot. So then I later on realized that, oh, it's not because of, you know, I have become something so special in the second case. Or it's not because that I'm just so ordinary, so basic during the first case. It's simply because of the workings of the imprints. You know, during the first time, since that my imprint was absolutely zero, you know, it was the time where the imprints were being laid. So at that point, when that was happening, when simply during the first implanting of the imprints, you really don't understand anything. Actually, there is taking the root has already started. But during the second, because of this imprint, you can understand everything so easily. You know? Yeah. So, this is my personal experience. And it's not a matter of simply encouraging you, but is to inform you, to let you know as to how imprints work, and that you should not be feeling discouraged. Rather, you should be feeling so happy if some feeling of uneasiness is happening in you, that we are not learning anything this time. Yeah. Okay. So whereas if you think that, oh, I've learned a great deal, this means that very likely either you are Manjushri or you are zero. Yeah. Okay. So whereas if you there's the feeling of uneasiness happening, it's a good sign. And see whether what I'm saying is correct. You try to receive the same teaching, you know, from someone else, and then you'll see how sparkling, you know, it'll be like. Okay, next. Assertions regarding object possessors. So we are done with the objects, now the subjects. And this section has three parts. Again, persons, consciousness, and terms, same, exactly the same as Upabhashika. There could be some differences. Say persons. So what do you understand about a person, you know, as the subject? Subject or object, this is what basically I've already explained to you earlier. Say, you know, anyone, tell me, you know, what does it mean by object, what does it mean by subject in this context? In this context. Anyone? Just give me your own thoughts.
Subject is the actor and the object's acted on.
Good.
Yeah, the object's out there, the subject is here.
Good. See? Good. That's it, yeah. So now this is the basic idea. So as I'm happy to know that you are trying to understand things on the basis of our common, you know, usage of the terminologies. That's really very important. Don't try to make things so complicated unnecessarily, right? Now the question is, in terms of objects, you know, we have covered, in fact, everything which is to be known, which you discuss about, they fall under the objects, right? Okay. And since that, so how many objects are there? 10, 20?
Endless,
yeah, infinite.
Countless.
Yeah, countless. So since that, to know the objects, if you are to really struggle to understand each of the objects, you know, is as numerous as, you know, the particles, you know. Even you can multiply particles, number of particles by, you know, millions, still the number of objects will not exhaust. And even if you know all these objects, I don't know if there is any special benefit. So now to make the benefit, to make a purpose, to extract the purpose, you know, by knowing the objects, the author, and in fact it is a Buddha, and later on by, you know, Aryamanjushri and Buddha Maitreya, and then later on, still later on by Aranagarjuna and Aryasanga and these masters, you know, they put it, they encapsulated the whole phenomena or whole objects in, you know, such a beautiful way by which you learn that way of categorizing the phenomena, and then there is a great development, maturation of your mind happening towards the path. So how? Into two truths. You know, because of which you tend to realize the ignorance which has been obscuring us from enlightenment, you know, since beginning of time, because of understanding the two truths. And everything, all objects can be classified into these two truths, right? And then into the single and different, or, you know, the sameness and the differentness. Again, from that, you come to know how things can possibly exist as single entity-wise, you know, and however different nominal, you know, level. So again, from there, you have learned this, because of which you come to discover that there's a disparity between appearance and the reality. Appearance-wise, two. Reality, one. You know, you come to discover this reality. And because of which, we come to know, again, this helps us know that, in fact, we are not to rely on the appearance purely. Because, you know, appearance may not necessarily reflect the reality. There's a gap. This is what we have discovered from learning this concept of the sameness and the distinctness, right? Okay, so similarly, so these are the ways and manner these past great masters, they have grouped all phenomena into these categories so that the understanding can have great effect and benefit for us. Rather than simply saying that, oh, in objects there are all different kinds, like apples, like trees, stones, what's the benefit in learning this? You know? So, say for example, apples and non-apples. This is one way of classifying all phenomena into two groups. Apples and non-apples. So what is the benefit of learning this? You know? Yeah. So, however, you know, there are ways and means to classify the phenomena into groups, whereby through learning that will really help you upgrade along the path to enlightenment. Okay, now with the subjects. The subjects, last time we have already studied during the tenet of Vaibhashika, where the subjects are classified into three: the persons, consciousness, and terms, right? So can you think of anything else? Don't be so rigid, you know, fixed with what is said there in the text. Can you think of any subject or agent, you know, which may not necessarily fall in one of these three categories? The person, consciousness, and terms.
Why should terms even be in there?
Say for example, Hi Venerable Jambal, you know, the question you came up with yesterday is so striking. So everybody will look at, you know, everybody will not look at up in the sky. And some, you know, looking at you, some looking at others. No, they will all look at you. What made them look at you, you know, to this object? This word, this term. Hey, Venerable Jambal, I said it, you know. So because of this, everybody immediately, you know, this word Jambal is really striking you. It connects you. Connects to you. So that other people, you know, I see, everybody will seem direct your face towards you, right? So this indicates that this term is a subject. It let others connect to the object. But not the sound of the water. Not just all sounds. The sounds which has this, you know, which is intended for that particular, intended to connect someone to that particular object. So can you think of any other, you know, agent?
Written word?
Sorry?
Written word?
Oh. A word cannot be written. It's a script.
Written script, yes.
Oh, that's interesting. For example, you know, to the Buddha I make prostration, you know. So the Buddha over there, you know, the just a word, the script has a B-U-D-D-H-A, you know. So it doesn't mean that, oh, you know, I go refuge to the trees and these things. It is specifying to something else, very specific, right? So is that, isn't that Okay, this is an issue. First, let's say, isn't that the subject? Because it connects people to a specific object, Buddha, right? So what would be your take on this? Is it subject or not? This is a wonderful thing, yeah.
The term is subject, and I don't see why that would be.
The term connotes a sound. This is what I'm telling you. So don't try to, make yourself rigid, to put yourself in this very enclosed thought, Simply trying to, don't say that, oh, perhaps my understanding of a subject could be wrong. I might need to expand it. This should be your openness, right? Don't simply confine, enclose yourself in the understanding you already have. You need to confine. If this is what you really want to do, then you are saying that, oh, I'm not opening myself to enlightenment, because this is already my understanding. Everything exists so truly, independently. How come that things don't exist independently? You don't want to open yourself to these new ideas,
meaning.
Right? Sorry?
Meaning.
What?
Meaning would be the subject, both in that example.
Which meaning?
The meaning of the sign with the script on it is an object. But the meaning of those letters is the term, it's a meaning anyway.
Okay.
The meaning is a subject.
So what Venerable Thapala is saying is that the scripts over there are not the subject, but the meaning represented by these, right? Mm-hmm. The meanings represented by these scripts are the subjects. Sorry?
Because it's a person then.
So what is the meaning represented by that script, Buddha?
What is the meaning?
The Buddha.
Yeah.
Say, or table, instead of Buddha. If the script says T-A-B-L-E, so what would be the meaning of that?
Table.
So is that script, what is represented by that script, is that subject?
What is represented by that script?
Yes?
Yeah.
The table. Is table subject?
Object
and subject may not contradict. There could be something, even the Buddha, even persons, they are subject and object both.
Yeah.
Right? So simply don't say that, or you can say that, oh, it's just object.
Yeah.
It's just object. Instead of saying it's object. Right?
The meaning of the word is subject. The actual thing over there.
The meaning of the word
is the subject.
The meaning of table is subject.
Yeah, but the table itself is an object.
The table is not subject.
Correct.
Right? So what is represented by that script is not the subject. But it points to an object. So how would you define subject?
How do you define subject?
Yeah. So something I would define as, something which possesses an object.
Really?
Yeah.
So the table can be subject.
No, table is not no object.
Table can be subject, can it?
Table can't be subject because it has no object.
It has legs.
No, so that doesn't mean it is object.
No, that means it's subject. It possesses legs. It has its
no, legs. No. I don't mean to say that. I'm not saying that. The something which has a leg should be subject. I don't say that. I said something which is object. Leg is an object, but still, because of this is a law logic. No. The leg is object, but because one is in possession of a leg, it doesn't mean that you possess object.
So we have to define possess.
Yeah. Say you are a son, right? You are a son, and Abby has you, but Abby doesn't have a son. Yeah, right. Does Abby?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. So he's a son.
Yeah.
But Abby hasn't a son. But Abby has, Jumble. But Jumble being a son and Abby having him doesn't mean that Abby has a son.
Right.
table has a leg.
But it doesn't mean the table has an object. Object means, you know.
It's a defined object, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Object. Object means. So let's see how a bug can define it. Just check it. Actually, it is our responsible, common responsibility to make sure that what is already said there.
That yeah. Which is suitable to be known by an awareness.
Oh, that's good, yeah. Which is, you know, suitable to be known by an awareness.
So cognition has got to be involved in a characteristic of
the Yeah. So it has the connotation, you know, it is a connotation which is suitable to be known by an awareness, consciousness, or which is suitable to be, you know, cited by a term. Cited or stated.
Cited by a term. Yeah. That was in here also?
Is that?
I don't know. No, where'd you guys find that?
Remember where
it's
in
there?
It's not there. It doesn't matter.
Oh, you just added it on your own.
No, it doesn't matter. So, you know, your job is to... Your job, you know, I can come up with something else, you know, your job is to trap me within, you know, trap me within the inconsistency of what is said in the text and with what I said. You know, sometimes I can say something, but may not necessarily go inconsistent with what is said in the text, you know. Yeah. I can say, the text might say that, say, you're a human being. And then I may say that you are a non-devil. It's right, you know. There's no contradiction.
Right.
Right?
But not necessarily.
No, it doesn't mean. So there's no contradiction. This is what I'm saying. Right? So your job is to point to the contradiction. If I say something which is not there in the text, then you try to bring in that, you know, what I said, and you try to get something from the text, and then try to, you know, point to as to how explicitly make it, you know, just point to the internal contradiction or inconsistency, right? If you're able to do that, this is your success. Okay, so I don't want to spend too much time on this. The following scriptures assert that the continuum of the aggregates is an illustration of a person. So what is person? So the person is defined as the continuum, not necessarily defined, but you know, pointing to the illustration of illustration meaning an instance of a person. That the continuum of the aggregates is an illustration of a person. Say, we have the aggregates, body and the mind, and to make it still more refined, we have five aggregates, right? So the continuum of these five aggregates is the illustration of a person. And to be more precise, the continuum of the mental, the conscious aggregate of consciousness is a person. The followers of reasoning assert that the mental consciousness, now look, there's the distinction. So the followers of scripture, you know, goes in line with Vaipashka to the extent of saying the continuum of the aggregates, all the five aggregates, right, is a self, is a person. Whereas the followers of reasoning assert only the mental consciousness, assert that the mental consciousness is an illustration of a person. So in this connection, let me tell you this thing. But Bhava Viveka, who is in fact Swatantra Madhyamika, and he is a great logician and a philosopher, and a great practitioner, of course. I don't know how far it is true about this narration. Buddha Palita, who is one of the principal students of Aranyagarjuna, he commented on Aranyagarjuna. He wrote a commentary on Aranyagarjuna's text, Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way, the main text composed by Aranyagarjuna. And then Bhava Viveka, which, you know, whose position about this, as to what self is, what I'm about to say, Pava Viveka, he is not happy with the interpretation, you know, interpretation of Buddha Palita. So he rejected Buddha Palita's commentary of the composition as a commentary on Aranyakarjuna's supplement to the fundamental wisdom of the middle way. And then Chandragirdi, he in turn rejected Pava Viveka's rejection of Buddha Palita's commentary. So we have now three persons here. And that the principal is Aranyakarjuna, and then after that there are three persons involved. First is Buddha Palita, who is the direct principal of the student of Aranyakarjuna. He wrote a commentary on Aranyakarjuna's text, A Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way. So then, to that, it was refuted by whom? Pava Viveka. And then, Chandragirdi, who through reading these two rebuttals and the contentions, he found that what Buddha Palita commented on Aranyakarjuna's thought is just stainless. So whereas anyone who rejects a stainless position is in fact to be rejected. So Arachandrakirti rejected Pava Viveka's standpoint. Right? And now look what Pava Viveka said. In fact, since Pava Viveka, he belongs to Swatantrika Madhyamika, and Chandrakirti belongs to Prasangika Madhyamika, right? Very likely Catherine's favorite philosophy, the system, right? So Chandrakirti belongs to Prasangika Madhyamika, and from the point of view of Prasangika Madhyamika, none of the aggregates is the self. Whereas Pava Viveka, belonging to Swatantra Madhyamika, believes that among the aggregates, it is the consciousness, it is the mental consciousness, as cited by here, as cited by the followers of reasoning Sutrantika. You know, the mental consciousness is an illustration of a person. This is exactly, you know, accepted by Pava Viveka and Swatantra Madhyamika all. Right? And Pava Viveka, he came up with a very strong argument to say that the mental consciousness is the illustration of a person, is a person. And he's in his Blazing of Reasoning, this is the title of his text. It's amazing, amazing. I heard that it's translated into English, but I've not seen that. In it, he puts the argument, you know, in favor of the mental consciousness as the self, said, Khojane nambar shabala dagita unsu dode, nambar shabani yansiba lembish dahino. It means that we, you know, so proudly saying, we would designate the consciousness as a self. We would explicitly, this is a little translation, we would explicitly designate the mental consciousness as the self. Because the mental consciousness is the one which takes the rebirth. Therefore, it is the self. This is the argument, his argument in favor. Let me say it again. We would explicitly designate the mental consciousness for a self. Because it is the mental consciousness which takes rebirths. Therefore, it is the self. It's such a concise, very comprehensive, and yet a very short, you know, statement. A very strong argument to prove that mental consciousness is the self. So, perhaps you already, you know, get some, you already know his argument. So now to put it again, you know, in our own vernacular language, what he means to say is that we all, whether you don't take the consciousness, the mental consciousness as the self, or you believe in it, we all being the followers of the Buddha, our basic standpoint is the belief in the former and the rebirth, the concept of rebirth. In which case, the person, you know, goes from the former life to this life to the next life. But the person being constituted of the body and mind, and since the body is left behind after the death, it is the mind which travels to the next life. So, on the one hand, we say it is the person who travels to the next life. And in true sense, through deep exploration, with analysis, we see that it is the mind actually traveling. So if the mind is not the self, then where is this self traveling to the next life? So naturally, it is the mind which is the self. So this is his argument. Okay, so one of the secrets that we need to keep in mind is that actually this is, you know, what is said by the previous great masters in the monastic universities. When you study philosophy or tenet systems, whichever school it is, you should make it a point that whatever is being said there, you should get a feeling of that. You should have a feel of that, you know, that position. Because it is not something that, you know, someone came up with his own, you know, a creative thought saying that, oh, this could be one possibility, that could be one possibility. It's not like that. Because in the olden times, these positions are really being held by a living person as his or her own personal, you know, personal standpoint. So we should really try to get a feel of the position, standpoint held by those great masters. Right? If you have that, then you will come to, you know, when you come to know that the some other reasons reject this position, then you will exactly have the flavor, the taste, you know, of the next philosophy, the profounder philosophy. Otherwise, you know, you will have a lot to say, but you cannot really have a feel of them. So that's sad. Okay, so now look, when you say the followers of reasoning assert that a mental consciousness is an illustration of a person, this is really very profound. It has a very strong logical, you know, support. So we should know that. Otherwise, you know, you simply are so biased towards what Prasangika and saying that, oh, no, no, no. So, you know, as long as you hold on to the idea of one of the aggregates to be the illustration itself, this means that you are adhering to concrete independent self. So with that, there's no liberation. There's always ignorance, you know. So if you do that, then you will never come to appreciate the true understanding of the absence of inherent existence, right? So whereas if you come to know, if you come to get a, you know, taste the feel of these experiences, these kind of positions, as to how, as to why they are being led, you know, they are compelled to say that the mind, the mental consciousness is the self. If you understand this, then at one point you might say that, oh, this is interesting idea. We cannot really say no to this so easily, you know. So with that in mind, then when you learn the real philosophy or the logics put forth by Prasangikas, and then see if that really works. You know, don't be biased. Simply see if that works. So when you really come to understand, appreciate the full import of the logics put forth by Prasangika against these standpoints of the lower schools, which they really feel, you know, out of their feeling, then we come to understand the ultimate, you know, philosophy or emptiness according to the Buddha's own intention. Now look, next, consciousnesses, prime cognitions and non-prime awareness. Actually, we need to, you know, really ask as to how come the mental consciousness is not a person. You know, so by citing by citing Sutrantic school, you know. Oh, how come you, Prasangika Madhyamikas, you know, how come you say that the mental consciousness is not self? Okay, so this discussion, actually we need to do more when the tenet system of Prasangika is explained. Next, consciousness. Prime cognitions and non-prime awareness are the two types of consciousnesses. We did that already. There are two types of prime cognitions: direct prime cognitions and inferential prime cognitions. Done. And direct prime cognitions are four types. Now look, there could be one or two additional things. Direct prime cognitions, and there are sense direct perceptions. You know. So look. So if you know all these things, not simply, you know, on the level of the mere intellectual, but if you could truly embody these teachings, then you see that there is a vividness, sharpness, you know, in your thought. And likewise, you know, which can be extendable to your meditation, there is going to be vividness. So with the vividness, then there will be a deep sense of joy within yourself, you know. Say, look, there are two types of prime the direct prime cognitions are of four types. Direct prime cognition, that are sense direct perceptions. Number one, are sense direct perceptions. Say, do you know that there is a table in this hall? Yes. Where is it? Say there are many tables, and it's right there in front of you as well. You say that. But how do you know that there is, you know, how do you know that there's a table in front of me? I can see it. You know, I can see it. Which means, yeah, directly. You know, it needs not reasons. It needs not, you know, put reasons to prove that there is a table in front of you. It's a direct understanding. So this is, so this sense direct perceptions, it is five. You know, what you can see, what you can hear, right? You can hear it, right? It's not that you are seeing it. Perhaps you might say that, oh, I'm seeing your hand banging. Then I can, you know, do it from beneath. You know? Still you can hear it. You know? And then, oh, there's a delicious food. It's not the color, the smell. You know? And then, oh, it's really nice chocolate. It's the taste. Oh, it's really cold outside. Oh, it's so hot outside. It's the bodily, you know, sense. So there are five sense direct perceptions. What next? Mental direct perceptions. Mental direct perceptions could be, you know, say, last time we discussed, Venerable Jumble said, the clairvoyance. Clairvoyance, you know, they are said to be mental direct perceptions. Clairvoyance is not, but actually the way to train clairvoyance, there is one technique. Anyway, let me keep it aside. Okay, you know, when you see something through one's clairvoyance, it's not that you are inferring, you know. And so sometimes you can tell, you know, from what the bad other person has done through the person's body language and these things. So this is not clairvoyance, this is through inference. By inferential means. So whereas, you know, you see someone, or before seeing it, you know, before you see the person coming, before the actual person coming in your meditation, or, you know, you can sense it. The person coming to you, and, you know, everything happening. So then the person exactly comes with the same dress, with the same tone of voice, everything just the same, you know. So these could be the clairvoyance and mental direct perception. And then self-cognizing direct perception. So this is a new idea. So, but I briefly touched last time, you know. When we have this light, you know, so in a pitch darkness, without the light, you can't see anything. So, even if you like to read something, you cannot read anything, right? So you then put on the light, and then you can read it. So this means that this paper is being illuminated, you know, by something, right? By something. So what is that? What is that something? There's light. So this light, will, you know, does the function to let others see the paper. Does the function to illuminate another object. Not only that we can see the paper, we can also see the light itself. So this means that there must be something which illuminates light as well. So what is that? There is nothing else, it is itself. So the light does two functions. One, to illuminate external things, and the other, to illuminate itself. Similarly, our minds, they do two functions. So this is in a very general presentation. If I make it complicated, it'll really bring headache to you, you know. So I don't want to, you know, introduce you to the world of complication of this part, at least for the time being. Surely next time I'm going to, you know, deliberately, you know, give you more confusions, because this is the first seed. Once you have that seed, then you become more ready for the complications. Without these seeds, if you are really, you know, brought to the world of complications of this issue, then the next time I come, you might say, oh, please don't invite him for, you know, for teaching. Okay, so for the time being, you are being spared. Similarly, our consciousnesses, they do two functions. One, to look at external objects, you know, something else. External objects doesn't really mean external in real sense, but something else which is not itself. You know, one function is to view something which is not itself, view others. And the second function is to view itself. So, you know, our consciousnesses, they have two functions. But this is from the point of view of Sutantika, Chitta Matra, and the part of Vaibhashika, not Prasangika. Prasangika and Vaibhashikas, they don't believe in self-cognizing mind. Right? Okay. So, Okay. And this self-cognizing mind, this is what I like to inform you. Because when you read books, you know, Buddhist philosophy or Tenet books, you will come across various terms for the same meaning. So the most common one is the self-cognizing mind. And another could be similar to this, self-cognizer. Still another would be apperceptive. Mm. Apperceptive. A. How do you spell that? APP or AP? APPERCEPTIVE. Apperceptive consciousness apperceptive mind. Right? Self-cognizing mind. What else? I think that's it. And some people might even translate as metacognition. Metacognition, M-E-T-A, metacognition. You know, some people. But this is you know, translate. This is the people use more in the context of introspection. Mm-hmm. You know, but these are surely what you find. Metacognition. That's right. Metacog- number one, most common one is self-cognizing mind, self-cognition or self-cognizer, metacognition, you know, meta. I don't know, you know, it seems like the people, how the people use it seems to give me the impression that meta connotes self, metacognition, you know, self-cognizer, same, metacognition, apperceptive. Okay, so these are the different words used for this meaning, you know, the mind, the ability of the mind to cognize, understand itself. Next, self-cognizing direct perceptions. So this means that the self-cognizing aspect of the mind should necessarily be direct perception. Right? Should necessarily be direct perception. And now let me tell you, you know, again, this is quite important, at least for to lay a new imprint in us, in each one of us. And direct perception and indirect perception, you know. Indirect perception may not necessarily be used, you know, so explicitly, so oftentimes, but this connotes that. Say, the flower in front of me, you try to look at it. Really look at it. See how it looks, right? You look at it. Don't look at me. Look at the flower. Okay. So now, you close your eyes and think of the flower. Right? You close your eyes and think of the flower. Now you open your eyes and compare the two. How does the flower appear when you, you know, when your eyes are open? And how does it appear to you when your eyes are closed? What is the difference?
Brighter and clearer.
Sorry?
Brighter and clearer.
Yeah, when your eyes are closed, when your eyes are open, it's so bright, and it's so clear. There's no barrier between the real flower and you. It's direct. So this is what is known as direct perception. And whereas, you know, when your eyes are closed, then when you think of the flower, it does appear to your mind. But how does it appear? Is it vivid? Is it clear?
Shrouded.
Shrouded. Yeah, this is the word. Clouded, shrouded, not clear, you know. So, which means that there is a picture of the flower coming in your mind, right? And is that a flower? No, this is just a mental image. So, you come to, you know, you come to connect to the flower. Of course, when you think about that image, you are thinking about the flower, right? You don't simply say that, oh, I'm not thinking about the flower, I'm thinking about the image of the flower. Don't say that. You are thinking about the flower. This means that you are connected to the flower. But you are not directly connected to the flower. You are connected to the flower via that mental image. So therefore, you are indirectly connected to the flower. So this is indirect perception. Right? So whereas you connect to the object, you know, without the need of that mental image, you know, any mind who gets to the object without the need of that medium mental image, they are known as the direct perceivers. Right? Okay. So, now tell me, how would you differentiate between direct perceivers and indirect perceivers?
One are permanent and one are imperfect.
No, any object that connects to the mind.
What is permanent?
I mean, permanent doesn't change from moment.
No, which is permanent? Which is direct perceiver? Which is permanent? Direct perceiver or indirect perceiver?
So from this point of view, the direct perceiver...
This is my question. You're already... Somehow you're already, you know, introduced to some form of logic and debating. My question is, which of the two is permanent, which is impermanent?
Permanent is the mental.
Indirect perceiver?
Yeah.
Indirect perceiver, is it a mind or not?
Yes.
Mind should necessarily be impermanent or not? Because impermanent can be classified into three groups. form, mind, and abstract composites. So mind falls under impermanent phenomena, right? So any mind should necessarily be impermanent. No, I'm not talking about the mental image. So this is what you should be listening to me so clearly, particularly when it comes to debate. Without understanding what the person said, there's no way by which you can participate in debate. Right? So I simply asked you, how would you distinguish between direct perceivers and indirect perceivers? This is my question. And Christina answered, one is permanent and one is impermanent. So which is permanent, which is impermanent? This is my next question. So you said indirect perceivers permanent. Indirect perceivers, you know, aren't they minds? You said yes. Any mind, isn't it necessarily should be impermanent? If you say no, it should be because it falls under the category of impermanence. Right? So now, what is the distinction between direct perceivers and indirect perceivers? So without these questions, you know, you might think that oh, I know it. But then you understand, of course, there is some element of knowledge of that, but your understanding might remain so superficial and, you know, unrefined. So with these questions, it will help you refine your understanding, you know, distill your understanding. Okay, so what is the distinction? Yes, Venerable Thabala.
Mental image is the distinction.
Say, one which uses mental image to get to the actual image. One.
Perceive it directly,
by five senses. I see.
Or mental consciousness.
Good. Or, so Venerable Thabala helps you. Good, yeah. So, you know, or to be very direct, to make sure that you are not trapped somewhere here or like that, to be very direct, simply say, one gets to the object by means of mental image, and the other gets to the object directly without, not via the mental image. That's it. Instead of saying through senses like that, then if you say senses, again you're trapped, you know? Yeah, then you put in difficulty. Okay, so this is the difference. Now, next, self-cognizing direct perceptions and yogic direct perceptions. So this is quite easy. Yogic direct perceptions referring to those direct perceptions which sees one of the 16 characteristics of the Four Noble Truths. Any of the 16 characteristics of any of or all or two or more, you know, characteristics of the Four Noble Truths is yogic direct perception. Don't simply think that, you know, yogic direct perception, oh, someone who has with this very strange hair, you know, and with strange clothes, then sitting in a meditative posture and his mind is yogic direct perception. No, you know. Could be very deceptive. Aranyagarjuna really doesn't assume that in appearance. Oh, so, you know, you just look at him and it'll really kind of, you know, attract you. It'll make your mind so calm and gentle, peaceful, you know. He simply looks like very strict monastic. Not like, you know, so fashionable things like that. Right? So yogic direct perception should not be mistaken for those things. Rather, it means an incredibly self-disciplined, self-disciplined mental state by means of meditative realizations. You know, to the extent where one realizes, you know, one of these profound topics, such as the 16 characteristics of Four Noble Truths and emptiness, these things directly. So if you happen to have that, then you are a yogi, and your mind is a yogic mental consciousness. Otherwise, simply assuming those, you know, strange, funny appearances, doesn't make you a yoga, yeah, yogi. Next, we are done with that. Next, the physical senses, such as an eye sense, are not suitable to be prime cognitions. So here are the distinction, you know. But Bhaskaras say that it's not just the eye sense consciousness, even this eye sense, you know, eye senses, they are prime cognitions. But here, prime cognitions necessarily should be a mind. So this is not just Sutrantika and all above, you know, in Buddhist schools. All other Buddhist schools excluding Vaibhashikas. There are five types of the physical senses, such as an eye sense, are not suitable to be prime cognitions. Okay, again, I need to clarify this point to you. Say, you know, some people, they seem to sleep with their eyes wide open. I don't know whether they are seeing anything. No, they're not seeing, if they're really in deep sleep, right? So, even if their eyes are wide open, but they can't see anything, you know, say you come up with, you come up with some kind of knife and these things, but still he will remain like that. So this is to say he's not seeing anything, right? Okay. Another question is, when will that eye consciousness become alive? Meaning, when will there arise eye consciousness? Even if your eyes are wide open, it doesn't mean that there's eye consciousness, right? So when does the eye consciousness arise? This is the question. So for that, we need to know three conditions. Three conditions for the sense consciousnesses to arise. One, the external stimulus, the external object as the stimulus. Number two, the sense, or sometimes sense power, or sometimes sense source. Right? Sense power, sense source, or mere sense. You just in slashes. Sense power/sense source. Number three, immediately preceding mental consciousness. Immediately preceding mental consciousness. So, if you have these three conditions gathered, then the sense consciousness will automatically arise as a result. Right? So why I'm, you know, trying to teach you this is to let you know that we need to distinguish between, you know, to give you a rough idea as to what it means by sense or sense source or, you know, the sense power. Okay, what do you think is the external stimulus? For example, oh, there's a flower over there. So there's a eye consciousness perceiving the flower arises, right? So now let us take that as the example. So for that, you know, eye consciousness seeing the flower, we need to have the three conditions preceding that. So what is the external stimulus? The flower, good. Then what about the eye sense power? I see, this eyeball, good. What is the immediately preceding consciousness?
It's the moment before you look at the
flower. It's actually the mental consciousness. The mental consciousness never ceases. It's continuum, right? It never ceases. So therefore, there must be the mental consciousness, you know, preceding. A moment of mental consciousness preceding that eye consciousness, you know? Yeah. Whereas in the case of dead body, the stimulus is there, you know, the flower is there, because it is not possessing mental consciousness which precedes, so therefore our consciousness cannot arise in the case of dead person. So there must be the immediately preceding mental consciousness, number two, right? And number three, our sense power. So actually, eye sense power, many of you points to the eyeball. And then among you, I saw one whose face was unhappy, you know, with this explanation. I don't know who that is. So therefore, we need to, you know, deal with that more. So this eye, you know, eyeball is referred to as the eye sense container, which means it simply contains. It is the container to hold the eye sense power. It is not the eye sense power itself. In short, one clue as to what eye sense is that contrast to, you know, the eye sense, the eye sense container, in this case the eye sense, the eyeball, which is perceptible to our, you know, to us, this eye sense is not perceptible. The five senses are not perceptible. So what we perceive is the container of the eye sense. Right? It's not the eye sense itself. It is believed that the eye sense is a very subtle form, very subtle body, very subtle. It is too subtle that our senses cannot see them. Yes?
Did you say body?
Body. B-O-D-Y.
Yes. Can you explain that?
Form. Physical form.
To me, that concords with science.
So, like what? Sorry?
Completely concords with the scientific explanation of how we see. I think they completely match.
How?
Because what they explain is that when you see something,
yeah,
there's the object, there's a reflection from the object,
yeah,
there's your eyeball with these lenses, the light gets put onto the nerve cells at the back that stimulates them, and those signals go to a couple places in your brain. And you can't, without those places in your brain functioning, you don't have sight.
Right.
You can have a functioning eyeball, but without these other parts functioning, you don't have sight. And all of those things that are happening, when you delve into how the nerves work, all of those things relate to chemicals and synapses and electrical impulses moving along,
yeah,
places. And all of those things are form, and form turning into energy,
yeah,
turning into form. Because it starts as a chemical.
Yeah.
That the synapses, some synapses are chemical, some are physical, some are mechanical.
Yeah.
So the kind of synapses we have. And then they run into electrical events, and then they run into other events. And so there is form involved, but it's very subtle that we can't see. No one sees these things with their eyeball.
No one sees what? No one sees what?
They don't see these synapses. They had to take an axon.
Oh no, we can see, we can see. We can see the synapses. We can see the synapses. Yes, yes, even with the microscope, let's say, we see it. We can see it.
And they can get down to electron microscopes and all those things at a really small level, so those things are formed.
We can see.
Except for where it goes into the...
We can see the synapses.
Right.
We can see the synapses. Otherwise, how can the scientists have such a gut to say that there's something called synapse while not seeing it?
Because they have theories for some of these things that they don't see.
What?
But the
synapses is something, you know, which they can they can see so clearly.
But they can't.
So it's a matter of, you know, it's a matter of the size.
Right.
So say, what is that? There's one animal. What is that? The name? I forgot it. Actually, it is... what is his name? The neuroscientist. I read his book recently. His book, In Search of Memory. What's the author's name? He's the Nobel laureate. Eric Kandel. So he did a research on synapses and these things. And he said that, you know, out of all the different the neurons that we see that exist, you know, actually which the human beings know so far, one neuron, you know, of that animal is like what is that animal? What is that that animal, you know? I don't know the name. I forgot the name.
And
it moves so slowly.
Slug?
Yeah.
Slug.
Oh, very much like snail. It's not snail.
Slug.
It's not a slug. But there's a very different name. So this is what I like to simply give you idea. You know, there's animal which very similar like that. You know? So the neuron of that is, is the longest neuron that, you know, even longer than the neurons of the human beings. So on the basis of that, they can do the research so easily.
Is it paramecium?
No, it's like a salamander.
It's like, you know, it's a very small, tiny animal.
Like a worm.
But, you know, broader than worm.
With legs?
No legs. It's, how it moves is like the snails. Yeah. And then he put, you know, he put the metal around that animal. Because it is from doing the research with these animals that he got the Nobel Prize. Okay, so so actually the synapses are what we can see. Synapses are what we can see. And the sense, actually the scientists, so far, they have no clue of what, you know, what it means by sense, powers of sense in Buddhist teachings. Okay, now let's move further away. So what I mean to say is that here, when it says senses, you are not to think of the eyeballs. You know, this is, what is that? It is the container of the senses. Okay, next. The physical senses are not suitable to be prime cognitions because lacking being luminous and knowing. So prime cognitions should necessarily be mind, which in turn is characterized by luminosity and knowing. They are incapable of comprehending the objects. There are five types of non-prime awareness. Subsequent cognition. So we already talked about the prime cognitions. Now the non-prime awareness. Non-prime awareness. And why didn't the author say non-prime cognition? So anyway, let's forget about that debate. So non-prime awareness. What are they? Subsequent cognition, wrong consciousness, doubt, correct assumption, and an awareness to which an object appears without being noticed. Okay. So, actually this is really very important for us to, you know, our goal, the whole purpose of our practice, of our, you know, faith in the Buddha, admiration in the Buddha's compassion, Buddha's knowledge, you know, is with the hope that one day we ourselves as well will become like one like him. You know, this whole thing. So this means that it is not our physical body, it is a mind which needs to be matured and finally become one like that of the Buddha. Right? So how do we go about that, you know, progression? So first, say our mind is more dominated by, you know, incorrect or wrong consciousnesses, ignorances. Right now, right, our mind is dominated by these wrong consciousnesses. So then gradually, it can then be improved to a state of doubt, right? Or say, doubt. Say, oh, everything exists inherently. This is the ignorance. This is the wrong consciousness. This dominates our mind. And then through the study of these tenets, you know, and then listening to the different teachings, your own reflection, then gradually bring some form of doubt in you, you know. Oh, it may not necessarily be true, you know, it may not be a necessary thing for me to rely on my perceptions for, you know, of seeing things to exist inherently. It might not be true because, you know, by these reasons, it gives me a kind of clue that things don't exist inherently, you know, although I then don't understand it fully, which means that you then start, you know, upgrading yourself from the wrong consciousness, the ignorance, to the doubt, to the level of doubt. So you're upgrading. Then through further reflection, through further receiving teachings, through further readings and meditation, then you become closer towards the understanding of, you know, absence of inherent existence. At that point, if you're asked, oh, do you think inherent existence, you know, exists? You would say, oh, very likely from my, you know, from my reflection, very likely it is not. It doesn't exist. Which means that, you know, you have correct assumption. You are assuming, you know. And the assumption is closer towards saying, no, it doesn't exist. Which means that that assumption is closer towards the valid understanding. So then, you know, so with that, it will come to correct understanding along with the subsequent cognition, right? So from that correct assumption, and then one day you just click the emptiness. Oh, that's it, right? And the first moment of that understanding is the prime cognition. And the second moment downwards, they are all subsequent cognitions, right? So this is how, you know, by learning these, then we come to know from what step to get to which step. You know, how we go along progressing towards enlightenment. You know, in what mental states, what would be the different mental stages for our maturation towards enlightenment. So again, this will be really very helpful. So now look, every bit of the things taught here, they are so helpful in our, you know, meditation, in our practice. Now look, an awareness to which an object appears without being noticed. This is quite an interesting thing. So sometimes what happens is that, say, you know, I'm so engaged with the debate that my mind is fully directed towards the you know, towards your answers, you know, the sounds. And then because of which, you know, say there's a bee coming up, you know. Actually my eyes are there, but mind is so directed, you know, towards your responses that I don't notice what's really happening there. And the bee is stinging. There's a bee sting, you know? So which means that I'm seeing it, but I don't notice it. Mm. Which means that I'm unable to cognize what's really happening there, right? So there's a direct perception, but it's not that you realize what's happening there. So this is what is known as, they are incapable, what's that? An awareness to which an object appears without being noticed. Right? Usually I translate this as, you know, non-ascertaining direct perception. That would be better. Non-ascertaining direct perception. You don't ascertain the object, what's happening there. And yet it is direct perception. Because you don't use the generic image, mental image. It's directly what you are seeing, it's direct. You know? And yet you are unable to discern, you know, what's really happening there. So non-ascertaining or non-discerning direct perception. Among these two direct perceptions and awarenesses to which an object appears but is not noticed are necessarily devoid of conceptuality. So among these different, you know, non-prime awarenesses, subsequent cognition, wrong consciousness, doubt, correct assumption, and an awareness to which an object appears without being noticed. Among these, it says, two, what are they? Direct perceptions and awarenesses to which an object appears but is not noticed, or the non-discerning direct perception, are necessarily devoid of conceptuality and are unmistaken. Right? Okay, this is a homework or classwork. Say classwork. Say, you know, first of all, let me give you explanation as to what does it mean by conceptuality. You know, conception or conceptuality. So conceptuality is the mind which uses the mental image to get to the object. Conceptuality is the mind which uses mental image to get to the object. That is conceptuality or conceptions, right? So among these minds, what are they? Subsequent cognition, wrong consciousness, doubt, correct assumption, and an awareness, and the last one, the non-discerning direct perception, and what is already taught earlier, the two of them, the direct prime cognition and the inferential prime cognition, which I said earlier, right? Among these mental consciousnesses or the minds, which do you think are non-conceptual? Don't look, you know, don't look at the last para. Simply go through, you know, do our own exercises. See, what is the first one? It's the direct prime cognition. Is this conceptual or not?
No.
No, because it's direct. You know, it's not conceptual. What is the second? Inferential cognition. Inferential prime cognition, right? Direct prime cognition and inferential prime cognition. Inferential prime cognition is the first mind which realizes the object through inference, right? So there, is it conceptual or not?
Yes.
Are you sure? Isn't it prime cognition?
No, to infer.
Yeah, it's prime.
Maybe using reason.
Yeah, we use reason, but it's prime cognition.
Yes.
So it's not conceptual.
Prime, not necessarily. Prime cognitions can be conceptual.
Well, how?
Because it's an inferential prime cognition. It's not direct.
No, it doesn't matter. It's still prime cognition. So how can it be conceptual?
Because it's using mental image.
Good. So don't simply, you know, rely on my body language or my, you know, words, my sentences. You know, I can be a trickster. Yeah. So, you're right. So, I'm testing your confidence. Right? So, you're right. So, prime cognition, you know, need not necessarily be direct prime cognitions. It can be conceptual as well. Because, when just imagine, you see the smoke there, and from there you infer the presence of fire. It's not that you are seeing fire directly. So you know, that understanding, oh, there's a fire over there, it's not happening on your eye sense level. It is happening on the mental level, which means that, you know, you're not seeing the fire and still you can conceptualize the presence of the fire there. So there's the image of the fire coming to your mind, right? So this is still conceptual. Two. Then what about this one? Now the non-prime, among the non-prime awarenesses, subsequent cognition, is it conceptual?
Can be either.
No.
Good. Can be either. So what are the two? What are the two possibilities?
Direct or by means of perception, which is called.
By means of inference.
Yes.
Very good. Very good. So. When the subsequent cognition is through direct perception, then this is not conceptual. And whereas the subsequent consciousness as the cognition, say like inferring the fire, inferring emptiness. So the subsequent cognition is done by what? Inference. So which means that it should rely on the mental image. So therefore it is conceptual. Then what about cognition? Wrong consciousness. Among the non-prime awarenesses, the second one is wrong consciousness. Wrong consciousness, is it conceptual?
Yeah.
Yes, no?
Yes.
Just raise your hands, those who say yes. One, two, three, four. Do you want to say isn't that? Yes, no?
Both.
You're both.
Yes.
Both.
Both. Oh, good. You two are correct. Why both?
Because the way new things appear to our eyes are also, it's also ignorance, so it's a wrong cognition.
Good. Good. Say direct perception. Say, you know.
Still still mistaken.
Yeah, true. Say, you know, oh, there's a beautiful cake on the table. It's Alex's birthday. There's a beautiful, you know, there's a wonderful cake on the table. And out of you always expecting cake on the table, and then you one day you start seeing it. You know? You're hallucinating. It's dark perception. It's not that you're using the mental image. Or say, to be a more common example would be, you know, you see a cable there, or you know, any wire, just a rope, and then you mistake that for a snake. You know? So it's, to your eyes, it's just a real living snake there. Right? But this is mistaken. So, it is direct perception. It's not using the mental image. Right? And yet, it is mistaken. Because there is no snake over there. So, wrong consciousness, or mistaken consciousness, wrong consciousness better, or defective consciousness. Defective consciousness can be both. Conceptual, non-conceptual. So whereas if you think, mentally, if you think that, oh, you know, although Prasangika says that everything exists, everything don't exist inherently, but you know, I truly think that things exist inherently. This is wrong consciousness, defective consciousness. Mm-hmm. Is it direct perception or conceptual?
Oh, conceptual.
Oh, conceptual, yeah. This is what you're thinking. On the thinking level, you know, yeah. Okay, so then what about doubt?
Conceptual
or both?
Conceptual.
Are you sure?
Yes.
What about others?
Conceptual either.
Well, I think, it's kind of a mix. So mix is either. Can be either.
Okay.
Right? What about Dennis? Sorry, both. Singular.
Conceptual.
Conceptual. Venerable Jumbo.
I guess I'd have to say both.
Venerable Chigi. Both. Okay. Kathleen?
I think it's conceptual.
Venerable Chingyi?
Conceptual.
I don't know who is right, who is wrong. I don't know. Okay, this is pure conceptual. But say, how do you say, oh, is that real snake or rope? I don't know. You know, it's your eye consciousness, you know. Is this real snake or is it rope? I don't know. So there's a doubt. Is that doubt on the level of eye consciousness?
No.
Well, sorry? Yeah, that's it. So, actually, your eye consciousness, the job of the eye consciousness is to simply give the information to your mind. And it gives the information not clear, you know. It gives the information, that's it. And it is not what decides. It is not saying that, oh, it is robe, or it may be, may not be. This is not what your eye consciousness is doing. It is your mind doing, you know. So, therefore, the doubt always conceptual. Correct assumption. Don't look at the next para. Correct assumption. Conceptual, non-conceptual, both.
Conceptual.
Can be either. Conceptual.
Conceptual.
Conceptual. Okay, you're right. Assumption means, oh, it's very much, you know, which means it's not your eye consciousness saying that. It's your, you know, mental consciousness. You know? Okay. Correct assumption and awareness to which an object appears without being noticed. Non-discerning direct perception. Is it conceptual? Non-discerning direct perception. It's conceptual? I see. It is not direct perception.
No.
It's not direct?
No.
Is it direct or not?
No.
It's not direct. Because I'm saying it,
yeah.
You know, non-discerning but direct perception. This is what I'm saying.
Well, what? Yeah, the non-discerning is a mental factor.
You know, so say, you know, is the bee landing on my hand.
Yeah.
You're looking at it. Your mind is directed over there. You know, it's your eyes. Are your eyes seeing the bee landing?
Yes.
Yes. But then later on, when you asked, "What happened to your hand?" I don't know what happened. You know. You know, so this means that, you know, you are unable to, you know, your previous eye consciousness is unable to give the information to you. You know, unable to give the information to you because it really doesn't, you know, the discerns or really doesn't, you know, understands.
No, the eye gave it to you. The eye gave it to you.
What?
Information.
Yeah.
I gave it to you, but you
the
didn't do anything with it.
That's good.
So
good. Good. But how do you know that I gave it to you? You have been so kind to the eyes.
Well, that's why it might be
I'm not sure about that.
Because you had an awareness.
All three of the conditions.
So say, you know, if somebody comes in with the chocolate, you know, tries to give it to your hand, and then you are unable to, you know, you are really...
But you're looking at
so
it.
You say, you know, you saw the person coming, and then you run away. So the person will say that, oh, I went to give the chocolate to him, and if you ask, did you give him? Oh, no. I went to give the chalice to him, but he didn't take it, implying that you have not given it. Give means, you know, you do the action, and a person take it. I went to give, you know, I went to give it, but it's not my fault. I went to give, but the person simply ran away, right? So this means that I consciousness is unable to give the information, right? It is trying to give, but it didn't give. Right? So, this means that, you know, it is unable to discern eye consciousness. Unable to discern, you know. Once it discerns, then it gives. This is the measure of whether the eye consciousness gave the information to the mind or not. If the eye consciousness discerns, then it gives. That's it. Okay. So, what about the non-discerning direct perception? Is it conceptual or non-conceptual? So it is always with, you know, the direct. Yeah. Okay. But of course, you know, this really needs to be studied more extensively. Yeah.
Sorry?
Direct. Non-conceptual. Yeah. So now let's see whether we are successful in our exercises. Among these referring to the two prime cognitions and how many non-prime cognitions? We say non-prime awarenesses. Subsequent cognition, wrong consciousness, doubt, correct assumption, awareness to which the object appears. Five plus two prime cognitions are seven. So among the seven, two, which are direct perceptions, and awarenesses to which an object appears but is not noticed. These two are necessarily devoid of conceptuality and are unmistaken. Unmistaken means it is not distorted. And three, what are three? Inferential prime cognition, correctly assuming, and doubting awarenesses are only conceptual consciousnesses. Then the remaining two, they are both. They can be either, right? Because they never perceive the objects directly. Okay, next, 117. When a consciousness comprehends an object, it realizes it within the context of having been generated in the image of its object. What is that? When a consciousness comprehends an object, it realizes it within the context of having been generated in the image of its object. Also, minds and mental factors are asserted to be one substantial entity. Okay, so this is a little what we have touched a little bit previously. So anyway, the first part of this, say, when so this is what I told you last time, that this presentation, goes in line with the the scientist explanation of the contemporary science. Say, when you look at a flower by your eyes, what happens is that the light from, you know, first light from the sun or any source falls on the flower and it bounces to our eyes, and then it is, you know, it is being taken to the retina at the back, you know, and then it is passed on to the nervous system and then given to the brains, you know, and then the brain says, oh, this is flower. It sends a message back. It's this flower. So we see that at the retina, there should be the reflection of the flower formed, the image of the flower formed. So which means that actually what we are seeing, how we see the flower, is by means of that image that is formed at the retina, right? So there must be an image formed in order to get to the flower directly, right? So whereas Vipassika, the most basic Buddhist school, says that no, there's no any image, it's just direct, you know, the consciousness and the object, no veil, it's just direct. Whereas, according to Sutrantika and above, there is this image formed. So, you know, we may not necessarily call it mental image, but the mind must get to the object by means of that image, right? When a consciousness apprehends an object, it realizes it within the context of having been generated in the image of its object, right? Through the image, the consciousness apprehends the object or understands the object. This one thing.
In the case of hearing and some or tasting or anything, there's not such a...
Okay, so in the case of hearing, you find it a little bit difficult. That's quite right. So how do you explain that?
There's a pattern that's generated. The same thing, you have a pattern in your eye, it's just a pattern of the firing of the...
Say,
same thing, it's a pattern.
The sound enters your ear in the form of, you know, in the form of the disturbances, waves, you know, in the form of waves. What is that wave called?
Vibration.
No, there are two kinds of waves.
Sound wave.
No. Yeah. One wave, you know. What is that? I forgot the names. Sorry. So one wave is, you know, yeah. There are two. The one which simply where actually, you know, is not the substance which is traveling. It isn't the wave, the disturbance traveling. So the first, you know, first the first atoms, they strike the second atom, and the second atom strikes the third.
Stationary.
So anyway, you know, so this kind of wave, you know, is not just like the wave of the light. Yeah. With the light, is the whatever is from the sun, it really gets to us. Whereas in the case of the sound, it's not that the substance originated, you know, which is passed from the object, is really what you get in your ears. It's simply the disturbance which is transmitted via these, you know, the atoms, or via these particles, right? So what happens is that, you know, the first particle hits the second one hits the third, and that way, you know, the disturbance is transmitted in the form of wave to our ears, right? So then, finally the eardrum is being hit by the most immediate particle, right? So depending on how strong it is hit, then it, you know, informs to the brain that, oh, you know, he hits me 20%, he hits me 2%, or 80%, you know? And then it says, oh, when it's 2%, this is what is known as a small sound, you know? Say, and the frequency-wise, oh, 20 times a second, 80 times a second. 80 times a second means it's the what? Very high pitch. Whereas just in the 20 times a second, oh, it's not too high, it's low pitch. You know, so this is what our brain tells us, right? So in fact, what is being said, what is being transmitted originally is being reflected, you know, reflected in the eardrum, That is passed into the brain, right? Okay. So again, there's image. Image not in the sense of the visual image, you know, audio image. Yeah. Okay. So, and there's a very interesting debate. So since that we almost, yeah, the time is off. So there's a very interesting debate. This is really very interesting. The debate is that, debate is from the point of view of Vaipashikas, who doesn't believe that. And the debate is really very strong, you know. Very strong debate. In fact, that, you know, that might give us some kind of clue. I don't know. You know, it's my speculation. It might give you some kind of clue to Prasangika's, you know, understanding. So, the Vaipashikas debate is that if you simply say, you know, it's like this. Say, I always use spectacles. Right? I always use spectacles. So it's like the contact lens. Right? Always, 24 hours, throughout my life, without ever removing it, since my birth. But this is not likely, but let's imagine that. Then, you know, and every time, say, you know, so there's just a small piece of biscuits, and you see the very big biscuit, you know. And there is a person with, say, 6 feet, and you see the person 12 feet, right? So this is your world, because of this. So this means that when you're seeing just one, you know, a small water, just, you know, one drop, and you see it, a cup of water, that amount, you know. So there, is the person seeing the real water or not?
What
he's seeing, is that the real water? Of course, the person, if the person asks, are you seeing the real water? What are you saying? I'm seeing the real water. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll see that. But, say you are seeing, you know, the world as it is. And then, from your perspective, you know, you're seeing just a drop of water, and the person, that person, you know, with contact lens, is seeing it, you know, a cup of, whole cup of water. You know, that amount. So, do you think that what the person is seeing is the real water there? In short, the image of the water, is that the real water?
Distortion.
Yeah. Yeah. This means that the image of the water is not the real water. Right? This means that we are not seeing the real water. Right? Okay. So now this is a very extreme example. Now try to simply, you know, reduce that magnification. Right? So say, we are all using that contact lens by means of our senses, in the form of sense. Right? So whatever. So if you use the image, so this is what Tantrikan up to Prasangika say, you know, we get to the object by means of, you know, the image. So this means that you are only seeing the image. The image is not the real world. Without seeing the real world, how can you say that the real world exists? You know? It is impossible. It is impossible for that person, you know, who puts on this contact lens since right from the birth to the death, you know, to discern what is the real size of that water. Right? So similarly, if you always see the images, this means that you are not seeing the real world. Mm-hmm. So how do you know that the real world exists? This is a debate. Very strong debate.
Because it functions.
How do you know that it functions? You know? Again, you say that it functions because I can see it or because I can experience it. All these experiences, they are seeing not actual function, but the image of the function. Yeah. Right? So this is really a very strong debate. And the next point, and then we'll stop here. Also, minds and mental factors are asserted to be one substantial entity. This is really a very important part. say, you know, in Buddhism, when classifying the world of minds, the world of mind, we see that there's the primary mind and the secondary minds, right? So the primary mind and the secondary mind, there are different ways of defining it. Let me, for the time being, define it this way. The primary one, the primary mind, is the general overall mind, which doesn't, you know, which doesn't deal with the specific functions. Which the overall state of the mind, which doesn't deal with the functions in specifics. Just seeing the overall picture, that's it. And whereas the secondary minds, so again there are different translations, secondary minds or mental factors, right? Secondary minds or mental factors, such as the wisdom, compassion, attention, introspection, feeling, jealousy, you know, faith, all these things are mental factors, right? So these are mental factors which are more, you know, the mental factors can be broadly defined as those mental states which are described with these specific functions, on the basis of these specific functions. The mental states which are described on the basis of these specific functions. Right? Say for example, wisdom. The wisdom or the intelligence, so here it is a mental state which is defined on the basis of its ability, the function of, you know, function of discerning the object. Function of discerning the object. So it has nothing to do with, you know, the stability of keeping your mind focused on the object. It has nothing to do with that. It is simply, you know, described on the basis of its function to discern the object. You know, whether it is right, whether it is wrong, what it is, and so forth. And whereas the mental factor of concentration, it is defined as a mental state which is described on the basis of its function of remaining focused on the object. Remaining focused on the object. Right? Okay. So, here what is said is that the minds and mental factors, the minds, sometimes, you know, this primary mind is also referred to as the mere mind. You know? So when there is the explanation, mind and mental factors, immediately that mind should not be thought of in the general terms. It means a very specific one, which means primary minds. In short, primary mind, mind, consciousness, these three are synonyms. Primary mind, the main mind, if you like, the main mind, primary mind, consciousness, and what?
The mind.
Number one, mind, the mere mind. This is mere mind. Mind, let me say it again. Mind, primary mind, main mind, and consciousness. You know, many people translate them, these as synonyms. Okay. So another question is, the primary mind and the mental consciousness, are they, you know, substantial to be one substantial entity? One substantial entity means entity-wise the same. You know, objectively you point to just the same. You know, so actually it is like, there is one man by the name A. So A teaches Tibetan here in Abbey, Srivastava Abbey, and A teaches science in Spokane, right? So when this person A goes to Spokane, everyone will say, "Oh, our science teacher has come." And A, when it comes to Srivastava Abbey, everyone will say, "Oh, our Tibetan teacher has come." You know, right? So it is the same person. So in Srimad Abhi, if you say that, oh, our science teacher has come. No, he's not a science teacher. He's a Tibetan teacher, you know. Whereas in Spokane, if they say that, if somebody says that, if you go to Spokane and say, oh, our Tibetan teacher, you say, no, he's a science teacher. So actually he's the same person, but because of his two different functions, he's called by two different names. So similarly, when you really go to point to who is the Tibetan teacher, who is the science teacher, who is Mr. A, is it just the same person? If you really point to. Similarly, when you really go to point to what that wisdom is, which that primary mind is, it's just the same mind, you know, when it comes to pointing to. But because of the different functions, you know, overall seeing of the object. And the same mind also sees, you know, also has the capacity to discern what the object is. Emptiness, this is emptiness. So from that respect, it is called as the wisdom. And from, you know, and also it can maintain the focus. From that respect, it is called as the meditative concentration. You know? And also it has the capacity to feel a sensation. It is feeling. Right? The same thing, when you go to point two, it's just the same thing, but because of the different functions, we call it by different names. Right? So therefore, nominally they are distinct, but entity-wise, they are all just the same. So, also minds and mental factors are asserted to be one substantial entity. Entity-wise, the mind and the mental factors, they are just one.
Okay.
Or should we stop here?
Because you said, what you said was the mind and mental consciousness.
Yeah.
Meant mind and mental factors.
Oh, sorry. Mind and mental factors. You're right.
Okay.
What is it written here? Mind and mental factors. Yeah.
Okay.
Mind and mental factors, or you can say are the primary mind and the secondary minds. Yeah. Okay.